But as His Holiness says, compassion is not enough. As Lama Zopa says, meaning well is not enough. We need the wisdom wing too. So this motivation for what we're doing is sort of expressed, you know, in the second two lines of this prayer. And the first two lines are for those of us who do identify with being Buddhist, reiterating our reliance on the Buddha and his teachings. Sangye charang soke chognam la chang chu baru dagni kyap su chi dagi chen yen gi pe sonam ki drola penche sangye drupa shok sangye charang soke chognam la chang chu baru dagni kyap su chi dagi chen yen gi pe sonam ki drola penche sangye drupa shok sangye charang soke chognam la chang chu baru dagni kyap su chi Dagi chonyen gipe sonam ki drola penchir sangye drupa shok. So if anyone's listening on the streaming, then good morning. So our last couple of hours together. We've been through all the stages of the path, touched upon each a little bit. So starting at this package, remember Lamrim, this graded path, this course that ends up where we graduate as a Buddha. So we touched briefly yesterday on the first point, Tsongkhapa's point, we need to learn, find and rely upon appropriately a valid teacher, a guru, a person heavy with qualities. I've heard it means that we need people heavy with qualities, that's for sure. And seeing the logic of it. Sure, we want to study it more in depth, all the in the Lamrim, all the points that they make, but the essence of it, like we discussed yesterday, the essence of it, finding a valid person who can reflect back to you and help you become like them, a Buddha. Then we look at a teacher's point, just get us going on the path, to give us enthusiasm to think about the preciousness of this life. That's something new to us. We do not think our life is precious because we're all miserable and always look at the bad things and look at what we haven't got. But basically our teacher's just getting us to do a bit of kind of market research, a survey, checking the universe and seeing the qualities that we have got are so rare and the things that we've avoided having, the bad things, it's just incredibly rare. So then, wow, amazing. Conclusion, action point. There's always an action point. Well, not wasted. How tragic. So then we enter into junior school, grade one, entry level, first step. And here, this is not quite yet the point where we begin to practice, but a teacher continues in his agenda to get us to get a wake-up call. Now he gets us to think about how this precious human rebirth will end at any moment. So we went through those points to energize us, to increase our wish not to waste this precious life. Because the concluding point is that the only thing that's of any use to us when we do die is the virtuous imprints in our mind. So then we think, then our teacher gets us to think about, takes all the vast from the body of knowledge about all the different realms of existence, Buddhist cosmology, the whole view of the universe. There are countless sentient beings, the vast majority, who aren't human and who are suffering. And all, remember these realms, this concept of the Buddha, this view, this observation of the Buddha, all these realms of existence are simply expressions of the delusions. The three main, or the three lower realms are expressions of the main, the three toxic emotions. So we think about this. Actually, we didn't discuss this. Well, let's just touch on this for 5 minutes. So maybe animals is a good example because we can see them, you know. And of course, look at the view we have of animals in our world. It's very different. We have certain animals we're obsessively attached to. Our little pussies and doggies, you know. Every Buddhist I know thinks their dog and cat is a bodhisattva, I swear. Utterly attached to our creatures. So because we confuse love and attachment, this kind of feels offensive to us, you know. And then there are the animals in our world that we are absolutely not attached to. We want to slaughter them immediately. The rats, the cockroaches, the lice, you know, the ants. Vermin, we call them. Why? Because they dare to do what our attachment doesn't want. I mean, we should be embarrassed by this view. This shows how absurd we are, attachment and aversion. So we loathe those animals, happily slaughter them, happily, doesn't matter. Then we have a lot of attachment to all the animals that people eat. We get very upset about that. But like I said yesterday, we don't get upset about the millions of cute little field mice who have to be slaughtered to grow the wheat for the vegetarians and vegans. That doesn't worry us. So we're so irrational when it comes to our view of the animal realm. And then there's the wildlife, all the wild animals we call, you know. We kind of revere them in some kind of way. So we have all these mixed emotions about animal realm. So what's Buddha's view? Yeah, animals for sure, they suffer like everybody else, they suffer. They have using the three levels of suffering, you could say that animals have, in a sense like this, they have the gross level, they get harmed and abused. That is clear. But like I just pointed out, we have enormous anger and compassion for the creatures that humans eat. But we don't have compassion for the millions of field mice who get killed for the wheat because we don't eat them, so we don't care. So we're irrational. So we only think suffering is the gross suffering. But only the gross suffering when it's... I think it's curious. You listen to this. Look at the mummy lion. Mummy lion, to get breakfast, the only method she knows how is to go stalk the buffalo, rip it by the throat, dies an agonizing death, screaming in agony, and she calls her babies and they sit and relax and have hot entrails for breakfast. And we bring the children in to watch it, calling it nature. But do you imagine if you brought your children in to watch and you got your cat and you provided it with a mouse and the cat, you know, kills it and eats it leisurely. You'll be accused by the social services of cruelty to children and they'll take your children from you. So we're so irrational how we see things, you know. Through the lens of attachment and aversion and our own, just absurd. So what's Buddha's view? Yeah, they have that suffering. Yes, animals harm each other. Yes, humans harm animals. And yes, humans eat animals. All of that, all true, 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 true. All pointing to the suffering of animals. That's just the gross level, though. That's just the gross level of suffering. We don't see the subtle level at all. We don't see their minds. There's nobody in the planet would think that your dog is suffering. If it's a happy doggy with chicken livers for breakfast and warm house and loving mummy. We would never say that dog is suffering. Well, one time, I remember I quoted, I think, I said, Lama Zopa said, one friend at Koppan years ago, Rinpoche said, if we could just for a moment, have a direct insight, a genuine experience of the mind of our dog, our little doggy, their suffering, and he means their mental suffering, will be so unbearable. We'd never wish to waste a single second of this precious human life again. Now, that's really abstract to us. We do not think our dog has got an unhappy mind. We don't even see it. We don't even see it at all. So what's he mean by that? Well, remember, Buddha's view of the mind, Buddha's psychological model, refers to all sentient beings. And if we can see humans and we can begin to look into our own mind and see the nightmare of the depression, the anger and the jealousy and the fears and the anxiety and the worries and the attachment and the concrete grasping at everything. Well, animals have that unadorned. Ours, fortunately, our saving grace is our virtues. So our virtues temper our neuroses. But we can still see them. They loom large. The less virtue, the more neuroses, and therefore the more suffering, and therefore the more harmful. Look at animals. They're the perfect example of the expression of unbelievable ego grasping, which gives rise to unbelievable attachment that will then do exactly what you have to do to get what your attachment wants. And then there's aversion and jealousy. Just look at all the animals, exactly the same. We see that. But they're unadorned. They're naked, disturbing emotions a trillion times more powerful than ours. Therefore, a trillion times more suffering. That's not how we see them. So we'll see the dog. Let's say the dog will kind of eat a baby. So we'll immediately kill the dog because it's so shocking. But the mummy lion eats the buffalo every day, and we call it nature. So there's no rationale in that. You know. The animal that we eat suffers by being killed, but the little kind of field mouse gets slaughtered so we can have wheat. We don't eat the field mouse, but we don't care about that. We think, oh, that's just, you can't help that, we think. So our mind, we're so irrational. It's all full of attachment, you know. We're very partial in how we see things. So Buddha's used the cause of being born into a goat running, you know, the cause of being born as a lion, let's say, is predominantly a deluded, a negative state of mind, probably killing, let's say, would ripen at the time of your death. As a human, let's say, you've never worked on your mind, followed all your tendencies, have masses of fear when you die, the tendency to kill will be triggered, and you run like a magnet to lion mummy. That triggers then all your karmic seeds that would suit a lion, particularly killing, fear, aggression, attachment. That's it. Then you have a lion. Watch their behavior. The behavior shows you the mind, shows you the ignorance. I mean, even look at the fisherman. We describe the fisherman, remember, a human being with super intelligence and kindness and a good person because of a tendency to kill plus the attachment on top. Blind as bats, never can see for one second that fish in the boat suffers. So that shows the depth of ignorance of even a human. Well, can you imagine the depth of the ignorance in the mind of the lion? Utterly incapable of ever seeing that the buffalo is suffering, ever. If a human can be that ignorant and we have virtue, then can you only imagine the suffering of the lion's mind, you know. So to contemplate is interesting. And we say, don't we, leopards can't change their spots. They can't change their minds. If we're fortunate as humans, look how hard it is, we can change our mind. That's the miracle. That's because we've got some wisdom, some virtue. That's what allows us, enables us to do that. Lion, no chance. So that's suffering. Not to mention the gross suffering of the animals, you know. So then the point here, Atisha gets us to think about this, because that could be a consequence of when we die. Of course it's abstract to us. It sounds hilarious. So then what's his point here? To increase our wish not to waste his precious life. Oh my goodness, I don't want that. Quick, whom can I turn to? So you see that there's suffering. You hear about all these people getting lung cancer. Oh my God, I don't want that. Whom can I turn to tell me what to do? You turn to your doctor. So what's the basis for turning to a doctor? There are two. One is you've got to want to give up suffering. Preventative or curative, one or the other. That's got to be your main reason for going to a doctor. You don't go because they're handsome. You don't go because they're pretty, unless you want to seduce them. That's not the reason to go to a doctor. You go because they're valid. So you've got to check up first. Check on the qualities of the Buddha. Here the Buddha is our doctor. So, you know, you check. You check up on the qualities of the Buddha. You read the teachings. You listen to you read the teachings, think about it. Get some basis for having a sense that he's a valid person. And then, of course, we can see, especially in the world, if we have people who are, you know, proponents of it, who are people living those teachings, that gives us courage, that helps us understand the qualities of a Buddha. It gives us confidence. And we want their methods. We want to stop suffering. Again, you don't just rely on Buddha because he's nice. The only reason to rely on Buddha is because you're sick of suffering. That's the purpose here. That's it, bottom line. And that means you've got to, you know, no, you don't want it. And the first level we don't want is the suffering of the lower realms. Of course that's abstract to us. Of course it's so arcane. Many Buddhists don't even think of this and don't want to think of it. And that's okay. You don't have to. You can be a 1% Buddhist. It's all right. Buddha's not the boss. You are. But we're talking the big picture here. Giving you all the teachings from the Buddhist literature. It's up to us whether we like it or not. This is the logic of the Lam Rim. So then we get to the point, now we start to practice. Now we start to practice. Now we start to put our money where our mouth is. We abide by the laws of karma. This leads us, each of these points is priming our mind. Priming our mind to get to the point of wanting to practice. That's all these other points here, why they're there at this point, why impermanence is there, why discussion of the lower realms is there, why refuge is there. That's the logic of it. That's a teacher's and Tsongkhapa's agenda. That's the psychological basis for it. Now we get to practice. Control our body, speech, and mind. Primarily here, body and speech abide, particularly in the vows, as we discussed, the power of vows, so stupendous. Being good is not enough, Rinpoche says. Just being a nice person is not enough. Our virtue isn't so strong. But virtue practiced in the framework of vows, vows are like profound, make it profoundly powerful. Lama Zopa said one time that a person who's got lots of practices, doing lots of spiritual practice, but doesn't have a vow not to kill, just that. And then another person merely keeping their vow, being a nice person, but living in a vow not to kill. He says, because the power of vows are such, and this is straight from the Buddha's mouth, you know. He loves his vows. There's something very powerful psychologically about vows. And I think if we analyze it, we can understand that. He said, the second person is creating infinite more merit every second and purifying their mind every second because of the power of vows. So what does that mean, you know? So when we discussed karma on the first day, or maybe second, I can't remember, we looked at the components that have to be in place in order for an action that we do to either be labelled negative or positive, because there's really only those two options. I mean, simply speaking, just keep it simple. It's much more nuanced than that. It's more sophisticated than that. But that's as we get more advanced, we'll learn about that. But here, the basics. And the key factor, the key component in an action is our mind involved in it. In terms of the harm to the mouse, they're going to get harmed whether you like it or not, whether you know it or not. They're going to die if you stand on them. But the karma you create when you stand on that mouse isn't determined by the fact that you stood on the mouse. It's determined by what's in your mind when you stood on the mouse. Well, there's many other things too, but that's the heart one. So the mind is the central thing. So, we need to drop lots of good, delicious, intentional, virtuous seeds in our little bank vaults. We store everything we do and think and say is stored in the mind. And one way it's stored is mere memories, and the other way it's stored is as imprints, seeds, which is the kind of qualitative way that what we think and do and say is stored as an imprint, as a reverberation, as an imprint, as a habit, as programming, as a seed that then produces our future. And the mind's the main player. So there's the mere bare bones intention, I will, volition. That if you want a boss in the person, that's the boss. Intention, I will. Just for me to walk out that door. If there is no thought, I will walk out the door. I promise I will sit right here. So that's why if we look at our behavior, it indicates what's going on in our mind. We don't see any connection because we're so stupid, we're so ridiculous. We're disconnected from ourselves. Unless there's a person behind me with a gun forcing me out that door, I promise you I have an intention, I will walk out the door. And then my body will carry me out the door. That's how it works. And every millisecond of what we do with our body and speech every day is driven by an intention. Shockingly enough, because we don't realize, because we're so programmed with all our rubbish, you know. So the first is the intention. I will not kill the mouse. It has to be that. And then your motivation is the one that gives it energy, gives it the meaning. Intention, I will walk out the door, has no meaning. I will kill the mouse even is no meaning. What gives it meaning is the motivation. So right now we're sitting in this room and we're not killing anything. We're being nice people. The rats can be happy. We're leaving them in peace. We're not killing anything. But you know what? If we're not thinking, I will not kill, we are not creating any karma of not killing at all. We're creating the karma of listening to the teachings. We're creating the karma of whatever we're doing with our mind. But we're not creating any karma of not killing. And we need, more than anything, at the end of our life, bucket loads of delicious, rich, intentional karmic seeds of non-killing just to get us a human body. The main cause of getting a human body when you die is non-killing. So if you're not putting many non-killing karmic seeds in your mind because you're fortunate enough not to meet many creatures that you have to refrain from killing, this is the irony, then we're not creating any more virtue. We're resting on our laurels. The reason we're sitting in this room now and not attacked by terrorists and rapists and rats is because of our past virtue. But we're resting of not killing. But here we are resting on our laurels, and we've got to create more karma of not killing. So if you want to go live in India in the rainy season where it's like Jurassic Park, then you'll be forced to have thoughts every second, I will not kill. When you go to Bodh Gaya in the rainy season, at dusk, the ground is a carpet of little flying living beings. So every second you're being cautious. I mustn't kill, I mustn't kill, I mustn't kill. Then you're creating some virtue. But sitting here in the luxury of this, I mean, I haven't met a fly yet. I'm probably in the summer, there's a lot of mosquitoes, right? Same as in Australia. I can see all your netting. Same as in Australia. But we have to proactively put intentional karmic seeds. And how to do that is by living in a vow not to kill. It's kind of easy falling off a log easy. They even say in the Theravadin teachings, the Hinayana text, I'm not sure, I've got to check up on this, that a vow is a subtle physical energy visible to clairvoyance, a subtle physical form. Buddha loves his vows. And they also, all the Tibetan Lamas will tell us, without living in the three sets of vows, keeping them appropriately, we will never get enlightened because our virtue is not strong enough. It's like a rocket boost to virtue. It's like incredible fertilizer for virtue, vows. So what's the logic of that? It just sounds superstitious, it could be. I don't think it's hard to understand. So, you know, when you have to learn to drive a car, just to drive the car, you have to learn, and everything we do is like this, lots and lots of things not to do, don't you? You learn lots of things to do, but you have to learn not to put the foot on the accelerator at the same time as a brake, not to turn the wheel this way instead of this way. You've got to have a list of myriad things. Don't this, don't that, don't this. Now think about that. That's how you learn to drive a car. That's what makes up your ability to drive a car, and then you internalize all that. And then that is in your mind every second, informing how you drive the car. Well, that's vows. But of course, as soon as we hear the word vow, we get all nervous. Someone's squashing it on top of me, making me squashed, you know. I can't bear vows. We're so emotional. We're so superstitious, you know. Vows are simply the method to learn to be a better person. Vows, not do this and on the road, is to learn to be a better driver. And it informs your ability to do it. It's logic. That's the power of vows. It informs your behavior. And what is Buddha trying to get, exhorting us to do? Turn ourselves into a marvelous human being. Vows are a method. So, Lama Zabba says, and the Buddha says, vows are so powerful that the 24 hours a day that you've got them in your mind stream, their power is such that you're ticking over virtuous non-killing karmic seeds into your bank vault every second. You're purifying the habit to kill. You're purifying the experience similar to the cause of being killed. You're purifying your environmental result of killing, sickness, etc. You're purifying all of that, and you're creating infinite merit. I mean, we are like idiots not to live in vows. I'm not trying to sort of be... I'm not trying to force you. I'm just talking. It's an easy way. It's like getting 1,000,000% return on your investment. It's sort of a funny example. We've got to use ordinary examples because we mystify all this stuff. Put up in the sky, karma, vows. Oh. We're so emotional, so attached. So, the essence of junior school. Rely on the Buddha. Live in vows. Mind your own business. Try not to harm others. Do a bit of practice. Remember Buddha a few times and you die with a happy mind and get a decent human body with decent conditions. Well, the other one you've got to add to that, Lama Zopa says in the death book he talks in this book, he says, one main cause to get the human body, but to get a decent life and decent conditions, that comes from generosity. So add some generosity there. Then you die with a happy mind. Bye. See you next life. Out of here. And you'll get another nice human mummy. You probably meet the lamas early. You just have to wait till you're 47 to meet them again. Meet them when you're a baby and keep practicing. Get ahead of the game. Who doesn't want that? Well, I mean, it's up to you to decide, but I want that. No, I've decided I'm going to go to Amitabha's Pure Land. That's another whole discussion of it. When I worked on Lama Zopa's death book, I never thought of Pure Lands. I'd always remember these Chinese people talking about Amitabha's Pure Land. I thought, oh, I don't want to go to Amitabha's Pure Land. I want to be a human, you know, help sentient beings. And then I edited this book of Rinpoche's. And it wasn't quite, the manuscript wasn't quite finished. I wasn't quite sure why, you know. So anyway, I got a letter from Holly, Venerable Holly, Rinpoche's Australian nun, one of his assistants. And this is in 2012 when Rinpoche just sort of getting over his stroke. And I think one of his first teachings, he was giving initiation into Amitabha in San Jose in California. And she sent me a rough transcript of some of the teachings about Amitabha's Pure Land. And I was suddenly kind of, wow, you know. I thought, no. So anyway, there's a chapter in there. We should want to go to Amitabha's Pure Land. So given that we're now talking about, we did talk about death, I'll just mention briefly what a Pure Land is. It won't take too long. So basically a Pure Land, if we look at, okay, we've got mind and we have body. That's it. We have mind and we have the four elements. That's the basis of that's the components of the universe. There are sentient beings, trillions of them, and there are the four elements. And even as it says in the Vajrayana, remember we discussed, all minds are conjoined with their own set of the four elements. So then the actions we do, the mental actions, the visible and physical and verbal actions we do, driven by the mental actions, this is the real meaning of karma, mental action, karma, action, mental action. This is the process we go through, the kind of the programming that produces the kind of body we get born in, the tendencies we have, the experiences at the hands of others we have, and the way the physical universe impacts upon us. So we can see that all sentient beings live in some kind of environment, you know. We have an environment. It's the four elements. So it's our actions that produce it. Of course, it's pretty abstract for us. I mentioned that thing that Lama Zopa said in the Kala Chakra Tantra. Whatever we think impacts upon our wind energies, and that in turn produces either sickness or health, depending on whether it's virtue or non-virtue, and that in turn then much more long, over long time, those actions of virtue will then eventually manifest as a very beautiful, harmonious environment, because the internal is impacted by the external. I mean, the internal impacts upon the external. The elements are there, but they have no energy on their own. They've got they're kind of nothing. But it's the mind that impacts upon them. It's very abstract for us. We create everything, you know, universes. So therefore, we have the lower realms. We have the environment of fire. Think of it: spirits and their external realm, animals. Everyone has an environment. So, God realms, due to virtue, have an environment of like blissful, radiant light and blissful, karmic appearances. They're still in samsara. So the Buddhas, a Buddha, the word Buddha refers finally to the mind, the enlightened mind. Pure, unmanifest, all-pervasive, all-knowing, all-compassionate, all-powerful. Like the Lama says, it's like the concept of God. Just similar. I think over the centuries, many humans, these great practitioners, have seen similar things, but it's the interpretations that are radically different, isn't it? I think I mentioned this. There's a Catholic university in Melbourne and they asked me to give a talk. So I had a 20-minute slot on this day at a conference. And until I got there that morning, I didn't know what to talk about. So I looked up the dictionary for the definition of God. And it said God has three essential qualities: infinite wisdom, omniscience, infinite compassion, infinite power. Well, they're the same characteristics that the Buddha would say a Buddha has. The difference here is Buddha's saying every one of us can become that, you know. So that's pretty shocking for the Catholics, I'm sure. So my talk was the similarities between the definition of God and Buddha. I'm not sure if the Catholics liked it, but that's what I talked about. Anyway, the point is, a Buddha is our conscious member is, we discussed this before, we had this discussion, you know, how come it's stuck in our body? It's not physical. So how come it's stuck? It's stuck in our body. Our mind, which is not physical, is stuck here because of eons of delusions and grasping at this. So our mind is like miniature. We can't see anything. So as we progress, as we lessen neuroses and grow goodness, literally our mind expands. Quite literally, our capacity for cognition expands until eventually all nonsense is gone. Your consciousness can only pervade, that can only ever be wherever there is existence. How could it not be? It's natural. So God is everywhere. As a kid, I used to love the idea of God is everywhere. I'd say to myself, God is in the light switch. I couldn't get it, you know, because I thought of everywhere as kind of specifics. And I think God is in the margin of my course, you know, my class notes. I gave up on that one. God is everywhere. I couldn't get it. I like the idea. So the Buddha mind necessarily pervades wherever there is existence. This is clear. And there's only one Buddha mind. There's only one Dharmakaya. How can there be more than one? They can't bump into each other in the sky. It's a concept. It's our human conceptual idea, you know, of many sentient beings due to delusions. So when you're a Buddha and I'm a Buddha and he's a Buddha, we're the same Buddha effectively. So that Dharmakaya, which is pure, unmanifest, all-knowing, all-seeing, all-compassionate, all-wise consciousness, that's the meaning of the word Buddha. But what good is that to idiots like you and me? We can't communicate with that. So out of infinite kindness, they manifest in bodies looking like you and me. The Rupakaya, the form body. And there are two of those. The enjoyment body, which only the Arya Bodhisattvas can see in their meditation. That's a subtle light body. And then there's the other one that you and I can see, so the Buddha himself, the human being. So that's not technically the Buddha. I mean, it is, but we think, oh, there's a nice human being with his curly hair or whatever. Well, that's Buddha, we'd say. Well, I'm sorry, at the time of India, you're walking around, the place was crawling with sadhus looking just like Buddha with a yellow robe on, and they wouldn't have probably had curly hair. Not like the pictures. I never know why they had that curly hair, but never mind, I'll learn one day. But you wouldn't have known one sadhu from another. You wouldn't have go, oh, there's the Buddha with his little halo or something. No, you wouldn't have recognized. Which is why we've got to check on the teachers, because you can't tell. So out of compassion, Buddhas manifest in a body to communicate with us. So there's the grosser level, the Namanakaya that we can see, and then there's the Sambhogakaya, the subtle light body. They also, that's the subtle light body, and they're the one, their environment is a pure land. Their environment is this blissful manifestation of perfection and wisdom that manifests as blissful, radiant light, blah, blah. So if you're born in like that, and Lama Zopa says in this book, the only pure land that ordinary people can go to, meaning people with haven't got realized emptiness yet, is Amitabha's. So I figured, well, all right, that's a good idea. Get born in Amitabha's realm and get enlightened easily. You don't have bodies. You don't have toilets. You don't have piss and shit. You don't have to have sex or food. You just live in bliss. I thought, well, that sounds quick. And then get enlightened quick. I thought, wow, that's very sensible. So I figured, now I've decided I'm going to go to Amitabha's Pure Land. And the fact is, there's one about karma and about, because we're so used to thinking, even when we're good Buddhists, and if we've been, let's say we've been Catholics, we still have this tendency to think, well, I'm sure Lama Zopa will see that I'm a good girl. I'm sure he'll take care of me. We've got to grow up. I'm in charge, you know. Yeah, I'm sure he will take care of me, but I've got to work. So you've got to decide what you want to do. This really kind of struck me when I worked on this book. In the same way that when I came here, I had to decide, I will come to Pamaya. I didn't just go, oh, I'd love to go to Pamaya. I wish I could go to Pamaya. I'm sure someone will get me to Pamaya. No, I had to decide first, volition, I will. Then I did the actions to get me to Pamaya, bought tickets, blah, blah. Well, same with my next life. No different, not a fraction. I've got to decide where I'm going to go. Oh, we all say, oh, well, whatever's best. It's like saying, where would you like to go for a holiday? Oh, wherever's best, you never get anywhere. You've got to be specific. I want to go to Italy. So I decided I'm going to go to Amitabha's Pure Land. I'm aiming for Amitabha's Pure Land. Even the end of the day, when I've hit the pillow, I turn on my iPad and I've recited the prayer to go to Amitabha's Pure Land, my Lama Tsongkhapa, and I have it in my ear before I go to sleep. So I'm hoping it leaves an imprint, you know. Then I figure if I miss the plane to Amitabha's Pure Land, I'll get a human one. And if I miss that plane, I'm in trouble because there's no other option. So you've got to decide. Anyway, that was back about death. So now where are we here? Pure Land. What did I mention? Karma. All this. That's right. Okay, so now we've finished junior school. I'm going over the points of the path. And now let's say we've got some sense of denunciation, at least of the major suffering. And we can carry on to high school. And we can get some Singapore concentration. Of course, we can get Singapore concentration earlier, but this is where the teachings fit. It fits here. It fits in the second scope. It fits in the high school. It's because now the high school is about mind. Now we get to the becoming a Buddhist. General ethics of being nice and not harming others is shared by all good people. Communists, Hindus, Christians. They might have different definitions of why you should have good behavior, but it's all the same. So karma, abiding by karma is the same as everybody else. Here, it's specific to the Buddha. Now we become a Buddhist by learning Buddha's model of the mind and using it as a basis for identifying our own mind. And this is a hard job, as we discussed, because we're addicted to the external. We are addicted to the external. And we feel like this victim, that things happen in here kind of just because we're responding to out there. We've got to shift that. We've got to make a paradigm shift and realize we have to be in charge of this one and change this one, change the mind. And this is what we do in high school. We discuss that. And then when we've got this, some degree of giving up attachment, basically, we've got renunciation. First two scopes, junior school, high school, wisdom wing. We're an amazing person already, a pretty incredible person, subdued body, speech and mind, incredible awareness, clarity, content, fulfilled, you know, not so much attachment, not so much anger, not so much jealousy, etc., etc., etc. A marvelous human being. That's the result of renunciation. That's the result of the wisdom wing, even, you know, the first level, renunciation. So as Lama Zopa says, this shows how deep it is to get it, you have got renunciation when just the thought of another moment of attachment is so repulsive to you. It's like being in a septic tank. Well, one other time he said, it's like using used toilet paper. So it shows we have a way to go because attachment is our default mode. And that should be very, not depressing, but humbling. A long way to go. Now we can go to the compassion wing because now we start to realize, we know why I'm suffering. We've looked at the Four Noble Truths. We understand suffering, the three kinds. We understand the causes. We're on a case. We're on a roll. We're working hard on ourselves. Now we have the basis for realizing, oh my goodness, everybody's in the same boat. How can I not help? So we continue working on our mind as we've been discussing. And we go through the 11 stages. I didn't go through the 11. I just touched on some. It culminates in bodhicitta, this outrageous, I mean insane, outrageous, unbelievable state of mind, bodhicitta. Doesn't fit with our world at all, where essentially the thought of I no longer occurs. In the same way that the neurotic I occurs for us. You still know you're I, you're not silly, you don't think you're someone else. But that usual way we think of I, that does not arise any longer. You no longer think of ever of getting anything for yourself. That's gone. I mean, that's inconceivable for us in our understanding of the mind. Inconceivable, mad, insane. You're a mentally ill person, if you like, that we think. So bodhicitta is pretty incredible. And it means only others are your concern now, essentially. So now we go to the next stage. We'll discuss this now. The final stages of the bodhisattva path, the six perfections. And essentially this is what you're going to be doing, bopping along for life after life after life after life, accumulating more virtue, purifying more, and until eventually you've perfected the six, which essentially is what Buddha is. So the first four of these, I assess, are really perfecting the compassion wing. You're working in relation to sentient beings. And these four are the practice of generosity, the practice of morality or ethics, the practice of patience and the practice of joyful effort. So it sort of seems a bit of an arbitrary collection of just four things, you know, but somehow very powerful when you read about them. And the last two are where you're perfecting the wisdom wing, concentration and insight into emptiness. So the bodhisattva going from life to life in their daily life, bopping around in relation to sentient beings, accumulating as much merit as possible, life after life, and in their meditation, realizing emptiness. So what's generosity? Well, there's three levels I teach. The first is giving things, material things, and that's the only kind of way we ever think about it normally. The second one is giving advice, giving spiritual advice. It's meant to be more difficult. But I think we love doing that. We'll give advice to anybody. We don't like giving things, though. So for us, it's much harder to give things, especially money. Third, giving, they call it giving protection. It's curious, that one. Helping animals who are, you know, saving lives of people. Helping people, you know, in difficult situations like being in prison, helping them out of prison, this kind of thing. Protection, protecting people. The giving of protection, it's an odd one. So the first one, let's look at the first one, generosity. I remember someone was raising money for the prison project when I was working. They gave me some money. They were selling their house. They're going to give me some money. And she wanted to help the house sell. So she asked Rinpoche to write a mantra on a crystal to put in the house to help sell it, you know. And he said to her, do not think of receiving, think of giving. So bodhisattvas, not to mention Buddhas, they're the opposite of normal people. As Milarepa says, look at the world and spiritual practice is opposite. So generosity, we understand the word very well. But because right now we have so much attachment, and this is just, we're normal people, We're needing something, or we've got to have this, got to have that, got to have a coffee, got to have this. Every second, because if we know if we just sit there in our house and don't get any food, we'll starve. So think of never thinking of getting anything just seems impossible for us, like not a possibility. It just seems impossible. So we utterly live our lives like this. So, of course, we try to temper our wants and don't be too greedy and try not to take other people's things and that kind of thing. But here it's to the point where literally if you've got this, if you've accomplished this, with bodhicitta even, you there's no thought to get something for yourself. There's no thought. It's hard to imagine that. So then think of giving. So this is very powerful for me when I was doing the prison project and I realised, because the way we worked was different from the ways that you amazing people work here in the way you do, you go out into prisons and things. I was telling, I mentioned it, because America is so vast and so many, much millions of people in prison. I mean like millions, you know. Like I said, 5% of the world population America has, but they've got a quarter of all humans on the planet who live in prison live in American prisons. There's a lot of people. And I remember living in California, even so big, and there's more prisons in California than the whole of Italy and Europe together, probably. And even just in San Francisco where I was living, you go 5 hours to one prison, you know. So it was like so intense, you couldn't do that. We could never have got enough people. So the program we mainly had was receiving letters from prisons. They'd write to us. So we'd send books. Our major program was sending books and giving them mentors to write to. At some point when I was doing it, we had like 200 people around the world writing to prisoners, giving personal help, support, and we take their phone calls. So it was a different way of helping. But I mean, we need money for everything you do. We know we need money. It's the currency we use on this universe. We don't use kilos of rice and bulls anymore. We use a thing called money. I remember when the first letter came to me from this prisoner, Arturo, in 1996, when I was editing Mandala. So eventually more letters came. And then as an extension of Mandala, we had this little project at the time, helping people in prison. But to even send a book, you need money. So I'd look in my pocket, you know, I was getting like whatever it was, a few dollars a month and my board and my keep. There was no budget in Mandala to give money. I remember that. But then you'd read this letter on my desk. It was on my desk. Not someone else's, my desk. And the need was very strong, you know. And because people in prison, poor, working class, no money, no people, no anything, then you know a normal person rings you up and says, "I want to, you know, what book would you recommend?" And you'll tell them, and they'll go buy it. Where can I do a course? You give them the website, and they'll go. You can't do that to prisoners. So they need 20 times more help. You've got to make 20 times more effort to help them. So, you know, we started this project. This is how it started. People coming in and people start to volunteer their time. Then we started paying salaries. But I remember this is when I learned for myself, this real, the one of having to make this shift of thinking we had to give. I'd read the letter. And the normal way we think is someone asks you for something and you're busy. Let's say you've got no time. So you say, I can't do it. I'm too busy, we say. Now, with money, they're asking me for things like a book that needs money. And then the first thing, of course, I'd look in my pocket, I'd look in Mandela's budget, there was nothing. So the first natural response would be, oh, I can't do it. I can't do it. So what we learned to do, we had to consciously make this shift. And I think this is for all of us in our lives. It's this brave attitude to say, I will do it. And then instead of saying, oh, I've got no money, can't do it, then you close the door. But if you say, I will do it, then you will find the money. So it's a brave attitude we have to change. And this really is now the one of enthusiasm. I'm leaping to the fourth one. And I'm leaping to the third kind of enthusiasm. We'll get there in a second. But it was a very powerful thing because when you read that need, you just couldn't not do it. You couldn't. And if we're even pretending to try to be like a bodhisattva, we can't study it and read prayers and get all moved by it and then when an opportunity comes, not do it. I mean, that means you're phony, you know? So slowly we developed this attitude, this conscious attitude, we will do it. Then we would find the money. As soon as you say we can't do it, you close the door. End of discussion. It was very powerful learning, you know? So giving. So you have to want, you have to practice. So this is the first step in generosity. Don't worry about putting your hand in the pocket yet. Your hand will go in your pocket to help the homeless person only when your thought says, I want to give. So we've got to start with a thought. And this is a powerful change because our natural assumption is we're not rich. Most of us aren't rich. Even if we are rich, I'm sorry, even if we are rich, we mostly don't want to give. Normal human beings. So it's got to, you've got to cultivate, train your mind, groove the mind in thinking, I would like to give. So, of course, here, if we were actual bodhisattvas doing our six perfections here, then as they say with bodhisattvas, there's no longer the thought of I. So naturally here, a bodhisattva, and that's what we have to try and train, is thinking all the time whenever you meet a sentient being. In the first stages of practice, when you meet a sentient being, you're playing safe and you try not to harm them. That's the first level of morality. Here, it's more proactive level of morality. It's actively benefiting them, which is really the second perfection. So here, the attitude of the bodhisattva that we have to cultivate is it's my job. A bodhisattva's job description is to help others. Not as being nice and friendly, but to know wisely what it is that beings need. That's what wisdom brings you. Like, I always think of the bodhisattva job is like a mother, a baby. You can't ask the baby to tell you what they want. This is very, very powerful. You can't ask the baby to tell you what they want. You have to learn to know how to interpret. That's what we have to do as bodhisattvas. Because technically, if we're bodhisattvas, they're trying to be bodhisattvas, we would never ask for a single thing. Never. So one of the things I did in the prison project, I decided I would never do any begging letters. I don't know what it's like here, but in America or Australia, you give one donation to one non-profit, and then forever you're bombarded by 47 requests for more money. Which, of course, is the method most non-profits use. And I remember feeling I hated that approach. I thought it was a horrible, manipulative, heavy victim approach. Give us your money. Oh, we're doing all this hard work. Give us your money. I thought there had to be more ways than doing it. And I made this decision I would never do a begging letter. So the 15 years I ran the prison project, we never did one begging letter. Never. Never. I never asked one person for a cent. I really understood that if we did a good job, people would see and move by what we did and would give us money, and that's how it worked. Okay, I lost some of the money. I did some investing and I lost money, I'm afraid. I'm a bit risk taker. I lost a lot of money, actually. I remember somebody criticising me to Rinpoche that I'd lost some money. So I thought, well, don't just ask people for their pennies. I mean, you know, our world, we love commerce, don't we? I think it's a really important point. Our world, we're very good at commerce. We're very good at making money. But why are we all so holy in our Buddhist centres that we can't think that we can use commerce? So I figured, let's use commerce. So I started doing some investing with the money this person gave me. But I lost a lot. I remember somebody criticising me to Rinpoche, and he said, no, she made effort. She tried. It's interesting, you know. I did lose money. But what I'm trying to say is developing the attitude of wanting to give. So we had to give to every single prisoner. We got 1,000 letters a month sometimes. We had to read it and want to give to them. It's a powerful and it's a brave attitude to want to give. So in our ordinary lives, you have to cultivate that. Start with the thought, not, oh, I can't give. Oh, it's too difficult. I'm too poor. I haven't got enough. So me, a very powerful, simple way to start training our minds in our ordinary life. This is very kind of clear. We all get bills, right? We live with bills. Many times now the money just goes straight out of our bank account. It's so easy. But when old-fashioned days when you have envelopes coming in your postbox, one envelope has a check and one envelope is a bill. I've never met a person yet who sees a check and doesn't get excited. And I've never met a person yet who gets a bill who doesn't groan. Oh, no. Why? Because we don't like giving. And you know what? The bill is, we've got to give it, and that's paying a debt, and we don't even want to pay it. Can imagine not, we don't even forget about giving money when you get nothing in return, which is a donation. But we don't even want paying, think about this, we don't even want to pay a debt. We groan when we see a bill. Oh no, we wait till the last minute, and then we curse the bank because they charge us extra interest. Because we don't like giving. It's very simple. Sometimes though, people are saying, well, I'm generous. And I remember that, but often it's just attachment generosity. I remember when I did the prison project and we used to pay salaries, and I'd pay salaries according to what people's needs were. So I remember one girl, one woman, and I helped her do her budget, because we're usually hopeless with running our money, so I'd help them do their budgets. I find it very helpful, very practical. And then she had, in her budget, she had, you know, generosity to beggars, poor people. Then I said, by the way, have you got any debt? Oh, yeah. I've got student, because all Americans have student debt. They're burdened by so much student debt, like $40,000. I said, where are your credit card payments in here? Oh, I don't pay that, she said. I mean, that's called stealing. So there you are wanting to give beggars, being all holy, but you don't want to bother paying your debts. Okay, at least negotiate with the credit cards. They'd be very happy to give you a break. But we just leave it. So that's heavy. Can you imagine not? You don't want to pay your debts, so you're blocking receiving. When we realize that we do everything to our minds, you know. So if you don't want to pay a debt, or you're happy if you don't get a bill, or if the bill is less than you thought and you're happy, you know, we automatically, because we're miserly and mean, naturally. I mean, don't feel depressed if I say this. It's how we all are. It's my money, you know. So then we realize the karma that we created to have money or not have money, then we're going to appreciate this much more powerfully. So if we have got money, it's because of our unbelievable generosity in a past life. I mean, be so blissed out and be so honored that you've got it. But remember, every cent of it is a result of your generosity, so don't waste it. So often we're either really mean and miserly and don't want to spend anything, including on ourselves, or we're really just want to waste it and give it all away. That's a completely irresponsible, you know. We should treat it with incredible respect because money is just the language we use for the fruit of our generosity. It's the measure we use, you know. We've got to use it skillfully, wisely. And the fact is, if we have any money, even enough to live, which is pretty incredible, it's the fruit of generosity. It's not because you're clever. It's the fruit of your generosity. So you would treasure that and then use it to get more future, you know, results. So the attitude we'd had to develop in the prison part was so powerful. We had to practice wanting to give. And like all things you start to think, it becomes a habit. It becomes a habit, you know. So Lama Zopa is famous for his generosity. He's famous all over the world for his generosity. You go into his room in Copan, it's like a pure land of statues and tankas and crystal and things. He doesn't have any money. He has nothing. He has nothing. It's all gifts from people. You go to his house in his retreat center in Washington State. You go to his house in Aptos in California. Same, they're like pure lands, you know. They're all gifts from people. And he's famous for giving whatever. I remember walking one time, I heard in London one time at the center there, he offered to one man who wanted to become a monk, Lama Zopa, he offered his robes to the monk. And there he is, Lama Zopa, walking out in his underskirt to go to the airport, you know. So Roger had to scurry around finding the monk to get his robes back. Or you see him walking down the hall without his shoes, you know, because he just gives. So if you give a gift to Rinpoche, you know how we treasure our own gifts. You might pay a lot of money on a beautiful statue and you give it so proudly and the next person walks out with it. So you've got not as much attachment, I promise you. He's like this kind of channel for things, you know, in one hand, out the other. That's generosity. That's generosity. It's a powerful psychological energy. We've got to go into the mind deep. And it's a fear that causes us to think, not want to give, because then we think I'll have nothing. And it's very terrifying. It's very real terror for us. So we've got to analyze these things, go beyond the surface, you know. So we've got to practice, you know, you're just not rushing around like some kind of silly person showing, oh, look at me, I'm giving everybody. You've got to change your mind first and start to, this is what bodhisattvas are, they're seeing sentient beings. We see sentient beings now in terms of our attachment. So if they're nice, we'll be nice to them. If they're smelly and ugly, we'll wish them to go away. So we've got to try and change that view to pretend to be a bodhisattva, which is the view that whoever's in front of me is my responsibility, like you're a mother. That's what we have to cultivate. This is the attitude we have to try. So those letters from the prisoners are a powerful example for us, you know. Train your mind in it. So, one powerful practice to shift your wish to begin to want to give. This is so simple, it's embarrassing. Whenever you receive a bill now, you get your bill, you get your statement, your bank statement, you see it on the thing, you know. Be happy, be delighted. Oh, I'm so happy. I want to pay it now. I want to give it now. And you give it now, you'd be delighted. So learn to be happy to pay your debts. I mean, you still will pay your debt, but look at the resistance. What do you think that's doing to your mind? You're blocking the ability to receive, which comes from generosity. So even if you think of your own benefit, generosity is unbelievably powerful, you know. It trains your mind. It digs that groove in your mind. And naturally, all the bodhisattva path is all about more and more opening your mind, your heart to others, connecting to others, breaking down the barrier between self and other. It's a powerful practice. So to simply practice wanting to pay your debts. And I mean wanting, saying, I'm happy to pay my debt. And why shouldn't you be? All those people working at Visa, all the people working at the bank, all working so hard, they're not thinking of you. They're all doing their job, and because of their work and their hard work, miraculously you're given a loan by the bank, you know. Sure, they get the interest. Yeah, that's all true. The capitalist blah blah, it's all true. But still, look at the miracle. The difference between us and homeless people is we have more debt than homeless people. They can't get credit, that's all. So want to give. Do not steal even a cent. Want to take such responsibility for every cent. Be so rigorous in your virtue, you know. If you get change from the shop and it's less, be happy. If you get more, definitely give it back. But our instinctive one is be glad if we get more. Be glad if we don't pay the debt. Be glad if somebody forgets to bill us. We can't help it because we naturally want for me. So it's a powerful training to simply want to give. Then your hand will go in your pocket more easily. And you'll even be sad if you look in your pocket and there's nothing there because you can't give. Like all these habits, it becomes a habit, you know. It's a powerful attitude. And I remember learning it with working on the prison bars, forcing you to do it. It's very powerful. But be reasonable and intelligent with your giving. If you have money and you do it and put it in, you know, getting interest on it, fantastic. Use your money. It's a brilliant skill and we are geniuses at it in our culture. Okay, be moral and ethical, but there's ways of making more money. Fantastic. Go for it. But be generous with it. And that creates the cause to get more. It's very powerful. That's the first generosity. The second one is giving spiritual advice, which I said, of course, is we prefer that because it's cheap. And we're happy to give anybody advice, even if they don't ask. So shut your mouth on that one and put your hand in your pocket instead. It's a powerful practice, I tell you. And done from wisdom, not from attachment. You know, going, oh, I'm giving all my money away. Don't be stupid. Use it, give it away wisely. Be intelligent with it, you know. But also the other one is when it comes to each other, don't wait. In our culture, we're so used to waiting to be asked for something. Tell me whenever you want something, just let me know. Tell me what you need, you know, which is incredibly kind. But if we're trying to be bodhisattvas and never ask for anything, it's a bit of a dilemma, isn't it? It's a bit of a dilemma. So you've got to kind of weigh it up. So that's where if we can try and practice, if you have, I mean, we also know this. If we have guests and you're a very hospitable person, you know how generous, you anticipate everything. The table is beautiful, the bed is beautiful, everything they need, there's a towels in the bathroom. You don't say, oh, do you want a towel in the bathroom? You just give them a towel in the bathroom. You know you need a towel in the bathroom. You know you want knives and forks. Would you like a knife and fork? You give them a knife and fork. Would you like dinner? No, you give them dinner. So we do know what humans need. And do you know how you know what humans need? Because you know what you need. Do you understand? Got to anticipate and be, but with wisdom. So that's why with Dharma centers, you know, I know you people have this amazing organization called UBI. I was just blown out when I realized how much UBI gets from the government. I mean, I just can't believe Italy. I don't know what, I mean, it's just beyond insane. They get 30 million euros a year from the government. Do you know that? I just absolutely mind boggled. I don't know what's wrong with your Italian government. They've gone a bit mad. I can't believe it. Absolutely astonished. I've never heard of anything like that in the whole universe. You Italians, like, I can't believe it. What? I don't know. No, you should keep being generous and it'll keep coming. Don't be sneaky. Keep being generous. Use every cent to do more giving, then it will continue to come. But normally in non-profits, you know, that's why people beg. That's for me the teaching that, like I told, you know, is to ask is our habit. Of course it is. But we've got to learn to know that we've got to be responsible. To know what people need, what a person needs, what organizations need, what the Sangha need, what Buddhist centers need. And if you think about it, you'll know. If you had to run that center, you'd soon know what they needed. And if you think about it from the outside, even if you're not running it, you'd know just by thinking what they need. By thinking about it, by thinking what a person's life is and how they live, you know, you'd know how, what they need. You'd anticipate. It's a very powerful, and it's for all of us. With whether the ant or a human or an organization, to anticipate, to think about, and then use your wisdom to know how to give. Maybe it's not appropriate to give to one person who asks you money. You've got to have your wisdom, you know. It's very important. The general attitude of generosity is to cultivate, as Lama Zopa said, do not think of receiving, think of giving. It's powerful advice, you know, and it's scary. Because we think we haven't got enough, we can't. So it's a very powerful practice. But this is practicing thinking like a bodhisattva. Training, that's what it is. So the next one is morality, which is really just what the whole path is. But as I said before, there's a distinct difference in these different approaches. The first level of practice, the wisdom wing, junior school and high school, the first and second scopes of the Lam Rim, is specifically, totally, totally the morality of refraining from harming, rooted in the concept of karma. Abide by the laws of karma. Do not kill. Do not harm. Do not steal. Do not this. Do not that. Powerful, powerful training to harness the crazy energy of our body, speech, and mind. Back off and don't harm sentient beings. That we are the direct beneficiaries. That's why for Buddhists, we make the biggest mistake of thinking, oh, I shouldn't be thinking that way. That sounds selfish. We just don't get it if we think that way. We really miss the fundamental point. We've got to be so, got to want to become a better human being. We've got to want to stop suffering. That means we've got to want to abide by the laws of morality. We've got to want to live in vows and see the incredible benefit to oneself and be blissed out about that. Do not doubt that. Because now you're prepared to help others in the same way. That's the morality of restraint. And the vows there are those vows. Don't this, don't that. There's no wiggle room. You just kind of lose discipline. Now we get to the bodhisattva level, which is outrageous, amazing, much more profound, much more profound. All the vows there are also don't this and don't that. They're also about behavior. Vows are about behavior, not mind. But here the purpose, the basis of the vows is to know how to do what's best for the person in front of you. So being nice to people is not the only way to be bodhisattva. That's just kind of corny. That's sentimental. Oh, I've got to be nice to people. No. Yes. But you've got to have wisdom, which comes from the first level of practice. And you've got to know what is necessary for that person in front of you. So as I gave that example, you know, of Rinpoche helping the monk in Koppan. This is obviously the more powerful level of a bodhisattva who's got clairvoyance. Buddha often says we can't really begin to benefit sentient beings until we can see their minds and their karma. So this classic story, Lama Harry, our friend Harry, was helping one of the monks, the Sherpa monks in Koppan, and he was very sick, and he'd found a doctor to help. And he told Lama Yeshe he'd found this doctor for the monk, and Lama just said, it's okay, he doesn't need a doctor. And Harry trusted Lama, he's his guru. But the monk, Harry could see the monk got sicker and sicker, and eventually went up to the mountains with his family, and he died. Well, that sounds like Lama Yeshe's being very cruel. That doesn't sound like kindness at all. Well, Lama Lundup, the abbot, told Harry, well, you know, Lama's got clairvoyance. That's low-level realization for bodhisattvas. And because of his bodhicitta and his clairvoyance, he can see the monk's mind exactly and can see the past karma and knew exactly the karma he created that's the cause of this suffering. So he could see that if he'd gotten a doctor, he would have got better and he would have been fine and this life would have been good. But he wouldn't have purified the karma he created and next life would have been much, much worse. Whereas Lama could see with his clairvoyance, you've got to factor in the possibility of this. He could see that if he had the sickness and then died, and he died very well, he would have purified all the karma and next life fantastic. Now, we don't have that level of wisdom, do we? But we can start using some wisdom. What is best for that aunt? What is best for that child? And the wisdom of helping sentient beings of a bodhisattva is a bit like the mother analogy. The mother doesn't just do what the kid likes. This is attachment. You've got to have wisdom to know what's best for the child. So it's tough love. That's bodhisattvas for sure. There's a much more powerful level of helping sentient beings. But knowing, anticipating what they want, what do they need, that's the basis of the bodhisattva vows. So the bodhisattva vows are all about don't do this and don't do that. But the key thing here, in the first vows, there's no wiggle room. It's just, it's negative if you do it. And of course, if the motivation is worse, it's worse. But in general, you don't try not to kill, try not to steal, try not to lie. There's no wiggle room. But here in the bodhisattva vows, the motivation for doing it is what causes it to be broken. And also here, all the secondary vows are divided up in relation to the different bodhisattva, the perfections of the bodhisattva. So there are some vows to help you practice generosity. There are some vows to help you practice morality, etc., etc. So, for example, in the vows in relation to generosity, there's a vow that if, say, you know, let's say Lara rings me up and says, come for dinner, Rabina. She's offering me a meal, okay? And I just can't be bothered. Oh, darling, I'm so busy, can't be bothered. Or I can't come tonight. What about another day? Then I just broke a vow because my motivation was just laziness. I broke a vow, a bodhisattva vow, because I prevented Lara from creating generosity. So these are more nuanced vows. We've got to know them well. Don't just say, oh, yeah, I've got the bodhisattva vows. What are they? Oh, I don't know. That's like saying, I'm driving a car. What are all the rules? I don't know. Well, you'll crash if you don't know the rules, okay? So we need to know them, but they're much more different. They're a different character. And you even have a vow in the Bodhisattva vows to break an earlier vow if it's for the sake of sentient beings. So when you get the really great Bodhisattvas, the high beings with real realizations, they can happily kill. This is too shocking for our ears, you know. We've got to understand the teaching so we can understand this. Lama Yeshe effectively let a monk die, if you think of it that way. But his wisdom was perfect. His compassion was perfect. So these are much more powerful, amazing vows. We need to know them. So the attitude of the Bodhisattva is to know what's best for others. The first thought is just back off and don't harm them. Now we even try to help them. So much more powerful, so much more expansive. But of course you've got to have wisdom, and that comes from the first stages of practice. And next level of vows is Tantra, Vajrayana, the most advanced ones. So the second perfection is morality. Well, it's the morality meaning help people. Help people. Who do you help? Well, whoever needs helping. It's like generosity of action, you know. That's all it really is, helping people. Who? Sick people, homeless people, crazy people, people in prison, your next door neighbour, an aunt, whoever needs help, help them. And it's again the same attitude. See the sentient beings in terms of, oh, wow, there's a sentient being. What do they need? That's the training, you know. That's the training. It's powerful. Of course, we can't do much right now. We do what we can, and we train, and we grow our compassion, our capacity to help. The next one is called patience. This is a weird one because you know we think patience is a dirty word. I think it means passive aggression. Do you have that term in Italian? Passive aggression. But patience is massive. In a way, we've been talking about when we talk about transforming problems. But here's a very specific, powerful, long-term practice for the Bodhisattva going from life to life. It's basically, and it says in three levels of patience, and these words are so heavy for us, patience, the first one is patience in the face of abuse. This is too much, isn't it? Abuse is a heavy word in our culture. Well, that usually means someone being mean with their mouth. Okay, if they torture you as well, that's difficult. Sorry, you know, patience in the, like, where's Julia? Patience, where's Julia? With her pain. She's not here. Patience, you know, with dealing with pain. That's powerful. That's not abuse. That's the second one, obstacles and things, you know. But this is a powerful one because we all know we've got rough speech. We blur everything out of our mouths every second. So it's bound to be someone's going to be a bit mean to us sometimes with their speech. Well, this is a great practice. And this is a miniature practice, but look how hard it is, you know. So what's patience? I think when we understand what anger is, no, when we understand attachment back in high school, this bottomless pit of neediness to get what I want every second, basically, then we'll understand aversion and anger and upset and annoyance and irritation, all variations of anger. Then we'll understand it because it's when attachment doesn't get what it wants. So we have this panic attack. Well, patience is the opposite to the panic attack. Patience is greeting the problem, opening the door, bring it on, baby. And it's powerful practice because it's obvious that it's smashing attachment, smashing self-cherishing. It's very clear, you know. So patience is not just passive aggression. It's not just putting up with something. Patience is accepting the reality of that obstacle. Like that woman in prison is the most perfect example. She tried everything in her power to get out of prison. And she said, finally, I realized I couldn't change anything. So she basically practiced patience. She accepted. So patience equally doesn't mean you become passive. So when she accepted she couldn't change anything, she also changed her mind, remember? I decided I'm not a prisoner, I'm a monk. I decided I'm not in a cell, I'm in a cave, which is profound. But she also didn't stop trying to get out of prison. But it wasn't angry, it wasn't shouting and yelling and kicking and screaming, which is the typical way we respond to things that when we get what we don't want. So the other extreme we tend to think is, oh, well, if you're going to not get angry, you're just going to give up. That's what we think. No. That's just passivity. That's called not caring. That's not the option. It's seeing there's a red light at the traffic. I can't change it. I will learn to be happy. That's what patience is. So simple, but it's profoundly difficult for us. And it makes the mind super powerful, super brave, super courageous. And we have 1,000 times a day when we meet what attachment doesn't want. And that's why we get exhausted, because we resist it, we hate it, we deny it, we blame, we get angry, we get upset, we get stressed. All of that is the variations of anger, and they're all the response when our little attachment doesn't get what it wants. That's why we're so exhausted at the end of every day, and that's why we kill ourselves or our boyfriend eventually. And because we've never dealt with it. We just let it build up. So patience is like a bomb, an atomic bomb. Makes us brave. But it's again, a wise state of mind. Not like passive. It's not passive. It's not passivity at all. And this is a very interesting point. This is my own observation. I'm an angry type person, right? I'm kind of volatile and that kind of thing. But, you know, when you start to understand the mind more, and especially when you understand this whole body type of path, you realize there's another way of putting it. You can see we've all got, there's a good quality and a bad quality to our characteristics. There's another way of putting it. So you look at patient people. I think patient people are unbelievable saints. And that, for the people who are genuinely patient, it's not like passive aggression. It's genuine. They see a problem and they're kind of like, I can handle it, you know. That's profound. But the negative side for a patient person is that they put up with things they shouldn't put up with. That's passivity. Can you hear the point I'm making? Patience is a good quality because it accepts what you can't change. But if you just put up with something and can't be bothered, that's laziness, you know. So that's a tendency of patient people. Now, the tendency of angry people is to jump in, criticize, shout, yell, and harm. So we've got to stop that part. But there's a good side there, and I see that in my own mind. Criticism is a good quality. Criticism, you can make it a good quality. Well, that's wrong. Then, how to fix it? Then it becomes valid. Then it becomes virtuous. How can I fix it? That's fantastic. I remember Martin Luther King saying that. It blew my mind. And you can tell by looking at that man, he's kind of a patient guy, you know. He wasn't like Malcolm X. He had a different style. But he said, it's good to find fault. It's good to be angry. He said, good to be angry, meaning find fault. Look at the racism. Look at the injustice. Look at the suffering. But then he said, and then you say, what can I do to help? That makes it profound. So an angry person's got to keep the action part and chuck out the anger. And the patient person's got to keep the patience part but chuck out the passivity. Are you still seeing what I'm saying? We've got to know our own mind well, you know. So patience is a profound state of mind. Patience in the face of abuse. Patience in the face of obstacles and difficulties. And then patience in relation to your practice. Huge, vast for the bodhisattvas. Then the fourth one, the most difficult of these four and the most important. And it sounds very odd to us. It's called enthusiasm. It's called perseverance. It's called joyful effort. It sounds like hyperventilating, you know. What's that mean? But when we understand the opposite, it's like bullseye. We get it completely. The first kind of perseverance, the opposite is called simply laziness. It's shocking to us to hear that. What's it mean? Well, we understand it. The first kind of laziness, the obvious one is can't be bothered, isn't it? Can't be bothered. So we get it. So what is it you can't be bothered doing? Think about it. The thing that takes effort. And what's the thing that takes effort? The thing your attachment doesn't want. It's so obvious. Because we want to stay in that. We're frantic, because of attachment, to stay in our comfort zone of every kind, whether it's the house, the body, the job, the relationship. We just don't want disturbance, you know. We want to be in our comfort zone. And the millisecond you've got to stretch yourself to do something you don't know how to do, because you haven't done it before, it makes us nervous. So we say, can't be bothered. This is the obvious one. It's the obvious obstacle. The second one is really tricky. It's a lie, but we couch it as virtue. Oh, I'm too busy. I'll do it later. It's the biggest lie of all. This is the most tricky. You know, what happens is this. I mean, I have these different jobs I do, you know. And fortunately for me, they're mostly Dharma jobs. So kind of, you know, I appreciate merit, blah, blah, blah. You know, aren't I lucky, blah, 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 Dharma jobs. On my computer, that's where my jobs are, you know, on my computer. And I have all these jobs to do. And it's so quick, you almost can't catch it. I look at the different jobs, and I know I like doing some jobs and not others. I love to edit books. I'd love to do this. But I don't like so much to do that one because it can't be bothered. But you lie to yourself. I see the jobs, and then within a millisecond, I jump over the one I don't want to do. And in my mind, I'm saying, I'll do it later. but later never comes. And what happens is what? You build up this burden, don't you? This burden of regret, this burden of all the undone jobs. And it builds up and builds up, and we can't, and it's so painful. We know it. And then when you finally do it, you're so shocked how short a time it took. You can't believe it took like 5 minutes, and suddenly the relief is incredible. We know this one. And this is our worst enemy, you know. Not the quite worst, the next one's even worse. We've got to be so rigorous with our own mind, you know. This is how we continue to perpetuate attachment. It's so subtle. Attachment to meaning, attachment, the eight worldly dharmas one, the attachment to discomfort, good feelings, not stretching. We don't like to stretch ourselves. It's painful. And we know anything you haven't done or you can't do well, you have to make effort to do it because you're not familiar with it. That's all. So we know if you decide to go to the gym to get fit. If you go to the, you know, you, like, you know, I know a few times I've been to a gym. I like the rowing one, you know. I like the rowing one. I like that. It's nice. So, you know, as soon as you do your rowing, and then as soon as it starts to feel painful, you stop. And then you say, oh, I did my rowing. No, you didn't. You are lying. You didn't. Nothing will ever change until you go beyond that point and start feeling a bit of pain. We know that. It's logical. You've got to go beyond. Get a bit of sweat and a bit of movement of the heart. Then you know something's going to happen. But that's how we mostly lie to ourselves. We say, oh, I did my practice. Well, I mean, probably we did. Better than nothing. But we didn't really do our practice. It's kind of blah, 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 you know. At least we kept our commitments. At least we didn't kind of completely break it. I certainly don't stretch myself when it comes to practice. When I'm doing my morning practice, I can't stop thinking about breakfast. And then when I do my evening practice, I can't stop thinking about bed. Do you understand? Laziness. It's okay, don't be depressed about it. We're all human. We've got to notice it and own it and see it. We've got to make effort to do anything we can't do. You've got to stretch yourself. It's very simple. Now, the third one is very strange to hear it this way. This worst laziness, the worst, the one that prevents us from achieving anything, is, it says, not possible. I can't do that. Not possible. And we think it's virtue. It's the worst laziness. So let me use an example. I mean, the lamas always say, this is a really important point, if you know the benefits of something, you will do it. We've got to know the benefits. So, of course, the benefits of becoming a Buddha are so bizarre and so long-term for us, it's really hard to have enthusiasm. Even the benefits of getting some, you know, practicing patience is hard to see. It's really hard to see the benefits. So it takes enormous clarity and courage to see the benefits of, to yourself, of practice. You know, it's very hard. We can see the benefits of all sorts of things, but even when you see the benefits to your body, it's still so hard to give up eating too much food, isn't it? We all think we eat too much. Some of us do eat too much food. I eat too much food. I get fat. Too many kilos on the body. Lama Yeshe was so funny. One time he said, you people can never make up your mind. You're never sure if you're attached to your body or the food. It's both, isn't it? So we go one between the other. But the point is, with enthusiasm, when you really know the benefits of losing weight, let's say, I'm just talking simple examples. It's not even really enthusiasm. It's just samsara. But give the good example. Then you will keep it in your mind. Every time you go on the diet, every time you go to the gym, you're remembering the benefits, and that will give you the courage to keep doing it. They're only really talking about practice here, but get the point. We all know the benefits of money, not because we're mean, just because we know what money means. Money is exciting to us. If we even find a note with 5 in the corner on the piece of paper on the floor, we'll think we've won the lottery. 5, you'll get excited, don't we? Because we understand the value of money. We understand its benefits. Nothing wrong. A friend of mine in Australia one time, I was a bit naughty. She lived about 25 kilometres from the centre. And I mean, I'd visit her somewhere. I'd be in that part of town. I'd see her. And she'd always apologise for not coming to the centre. And I'm thinking, well, I'm not expecting her to come to the centre. She doesn't need to apologise. I'm always so busy with the kids. Can't go. Difficult. Can't go, you know. So I was a bit naughty. And I said, if there's a cheque for $500, would you go to the centre for you? Of course she said yes. I mean, you think this now. This is a really interesting point. We know immediately, even if you're rich, you know the benefit of $500. We know it immediately, right there, that second. So that second she would have said, oh, what a good idea. Hop in the back of the car, kids, we'll go to the centre, have fun, get our $500 and come back. It would have been effortless because you know the benefit of it. That's a simple example to our minds, you know. So we've got to train ourselves to see the benefit of practice. It's not easy. It's not easy. It really is not easy. We've got to use tricks for our mind. But the third one, I can't do it. That doesn't sound like laziness. It's a very odd one. But that's just, it sounds like, you know, it almost sounds like it's virtue. But it's the worst one, and it's the one we need most. Because logically, if we look at the path, we look at the teachers, we look at understand emptiness and impermanence, and we see our lamas who have done it, then we know it is possible. We know we can do it, but one step at a time. Rome wasn't built in a day, we have been told. You pave the way. It's a marvelous saying in English. It's, in other words, it's cause and effect. But because we have this concrete mind and we see Lama Zopa, we go, oh, that's just Lama Zopa. I can't do that. And we stay stuck. So you can't, I can't possibly not sleep like Lama Zopa doesn't. I can't possibly. So I don't just go, oh, I can't do that. I try to remember when I go to sleep, to remember, like Roger said, for Rinpoche, sleep's a disgusting waste of time. I know I'm not capable yet. So I have to start saying, I'd like it. I would like to be like that. You can't just say, I can't do it. Saying I can't do it, like the money was the prisoners. That was the shift. When the letter would come, I'd look in the pocket, look in the budget, there was no money. And then the normal one is, oh, I can't do it. That's laziness. Because you don't want to, but you have to have the optimism to change it, to say, I will do it, I can do it. And that opens the door to then you will find the methods. But you've got to really stretch yourself to do that. You've got to make effort to do that. But it starts with that thought. And this is across the board in our lives every day. This is a major obstacle. Because there are fears, attachment to reputation, attachment to comfort. We just, oh, I can't do it. So like, let's say Lara hears that Lama Zopa is giving a special course in Iceland or something, and I'm in Tasmania, you know. Oh, Rabina, I just heard this amazing course in Iceland. Come with me this weekend. Well, of course the first thing you'll say, don't be ridiculous, Lara. Of course I can't. I've got to go to the work, the kids, the husband. I've got the money. I can't do that. Don't be ridiculous. Well, I haven't even thought about the benefit. And if you are clear that that's the most beneficial thing to do, you will say yes without effort and you'll find the means and you'll the kids will manage and the husband will manage and you put on your credit card and you pay it back. It's easy if you know the benefit. But instead of that, we get worried, oh, I can't do it. It's too difficult. It's not me. It's not possible. Blah, 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 blah. And we stay stuck. We all know this one. Are we communicating? We've got to have courage. See if it's beneficial first. And the point is this is what I found so fascinating with the prison project example. For me, it was such a powerful learning. I was at one centre in Brazil, actually. It doesn't matter where it was, but years ago. And I'd learned this with the prison project. I'd learned how to do budgets. I mean, I like all this stuff. It's details. I like details. So I learned, you know, if you want to make a plan, especially for a company or your house, you've got to have a piece of paper called expenses and a piece of paper called income. That's where you map it all out, your plans. You map out your vision. It's very easy. So I was at the centre, a sweet director, a little tiny centre, you know, little mouldy water bowls on the altar, no statue and everything. But he said, let's have a talk with all our volunteers and see if we can help the centre grow. So I got two bits of paper, one said expenses, one said income. So let's start with a vision. Let's start with a plan. You map it out. So I said, okay, whatever his name was, would you like a new statue? No, Rabin, we haven't any money. No. I said, I understand that. Would you like a new statue? No, you didn't hear me, Rabin. We have no money. I said, I understand that. I asked him five different ways. Would you like a new statue? And he finally heard it and almost resentfully said, oh, all right then. Are you hearing me? And then everybody got excited and started, oh, wow, they've been given permission to want something. So we started this wonderful game of writing down everything you wanted the centre to be for the year. This is really simple. Half the time these days I go around the centres giving this advice to the directors about how to run a centre. Not that I'm so clever, but I've got enthusiasm for it. You just write down a plan, you know, and it's right staring in front of you. And then you do the income, and then you do detailed description. How many people come into this, to that, to this, to that. And if you do a proper job and you create a nice program in the expenses side and the good income on the income side, and on this centre here, we did a detailed plan for the year. This many teachers, this many airplanes, this much food. You did all the details. You think it out and you write it down. People got excited. And then the income, there's a surplus. And I said, this is the point I learned, it did not cost 1 cent to think it. But we're so terrified at the thought of doing it, we say, I can't do it. So we close the door. We close the door to most things. We have to start saying, I want to do it. Then you open the door. And then the very action of thinking it through, that causes it to happen. It's very powerful psychologically. We've got to train. But the instinct of fear, attachment, comfort, what people think, changing things paralyzes us, you know. And the thing is, we admire people like this in the world. We admire that courageous mind, you know. It's possible. I always use example. Remember this example? Time for tea break. Remember this example? This is just samsara again, but it's a good example. I remember years ago when I was in the Bay Area in the 90s, I remember reading this article in the San Francisco Chronicle about one of these, you know, these young startup guys of, say, a tech company. I remember they, it might have even been the Google guys, I can't remember. But everybody seems to start up their company in their garage, don't they? It's very fascinating. So these guys, you know, they were talking about, there's a couple of them, two of them, I can't remember, but it really struck me. Their goal was their, what they call in America, their IPO, their initial public offering, getting onto the stock exchange, getting all the masses of income, getting all the investment from the investment people, right? That's the big goal for all these startup companies. It's their big dream. So they had this coming. They had to make their presentation. Something like for 9 months, 7 days a week, 18 hours a day working. Now that's busy. That's effort. Okay, it's samsaric effort. But the point is, it's so clear as an example. They crystal clear about their goal. They never lost sight of their goal for 1 second. Never lost sight of the benefits. Not for a second. That's what sustained them, and that's the point here. So the first kind of laziness, don't tell me they didn't wake up in the morning exhausted and rather go back to sleep. And the second they remembered their goal, leapt out of bed. Don't tell me they didn't want to put it off and rather go to movies with their girlfriend and eat popcorn. The second they remembered their goal, they didn't put it off. And for sure, I bet they had agonies of doubt. No, this is not possible. We can't do this. This is like the dream. No, we're not going to be successful. We can't do this. But they said we can do it, and they persevered. And that's what brings success. And this is the one we need. They say the bodhisattvas, this is the one. Without this, you will never get enlightened, ever. Now I'll have a tea break. See you in half an hour. Well, what's that? What time are we finishing? Lunchtime? Lunchtime, 12:30, right?
Yes.
Okay, have a half an hour.
Thank you.
Gentilmente Robina ha un'intervista, per cui vi chiedo di abbandonare il gompa e ci rivediamo alle 11:30, vero Robina? 11:12?
Sì.
Ok. E per una questione di, anche di rumori, di suoni che entrano dentro, vi preghiamo anche alle 11:30 di guardare bene se l'intervista è finita e di accomodarvi casomai in maniera molto silenziosa. Grazie.
Italiano, please. Italian. Oh, you mean for the English? Sorry, I heard it. Oh, she just said it. I beg your pardon. Sorry, darling. I'm sorry. Okay, I understand. I forgot.
So, Robin is going to have an interview now, so we kindly ask people to leave the group, to go out, and also when you come back, to be quiet and see if the interview has finished or not. So, please slowly go out, because there is going to be an interview with Robina. And
what's this?
Pretty much.
What's for?
For you?
Oh no, darling, I don't want your money. You take it, please.
No.
Shlomo, please. Come on.
No. Thank you very much. We have it this time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.